location, which has very interesting properties and very interesting consequences. I unfortunately did not, one of my homework was to catch up on what you guys have seen in the past, really, most of them. But so I hope that I will be at the right level and that I'll be using hopefully somewhat similar notations, but just stop me if there's something I'm skipping that you haven't seen or if the notation is weird. Okay. Try to be, you know, pretty general. Right. And these are the what I sort of base my little course on references. Winitsky has a book just on this subject, which is quite an overview. And I'm not going to go through the whole book, obviously, but essentially there's a review. This is extremely recent, so it's very recent research. The book is very recent. Then this paper by Komen Dalusha, so when we get to the point where we can talk about toggling, which is the decay of the vacuum, which is the nicest thing in the world. Then Komen Dalusha has a really, really nice paper from the 80s, which I really recommend everybody to read. It's one of the most beautiful papers, right? One of my papers. And so I'll try to review a bit what's in that paper, which is fantastic. And then there's this review, recent review by Warren Johnson, about double collisions and other classical signatures from internal inflation. I will not discuss much of it, but if you're interested, more info. Okay. So the idea of internal inflation is that there is this possibility that inflation never ends. And there's a possibility that you have inflation going on, and because inflation ends when you reach a certain point where you're no longer, you know, accelerating expansion, and then you eat. That's the surface of the beacon where all the energy is in the vacuum is transferred to some kind of radiation. And the idea is if the surface of reheating does not percolate, if it doesn't everywhere reheat, if there at any time there's places where you're still inflating, then that is usually considered to be a model where you internally inflate. So if I have a regime where I'm just inflating and then somehow I'm starting to reheat here and then to reheat here, but then I inflate again, and these things never actually meet because this part is growing really fast. It's inflating. So if the reheating patches never percolate, then inflation never ends. So internal inflation is essentially...
Globally.
Sorry?
Globally. Never ends globally.
That's right. It ends in these patches, but it never ends everywhere. So it is always, you can always find enough somebody who's inflating. And you can always find somebody also. In fact, as I argued before, it is still a set to measure zero. So that is, if you pick up somebody randomly, you will have reheated. Because inflation will have ended with probably one. But there's zero, but it's still a set of people who never reheat. So by eternal inflation, then we mean it's eternal in the future. So it's future, always, you know, some part. Okay. That's the rough definition. And then, but it leads, this regime is really interesting. Sort of just theoretically or philosophically, but there's also then the question is, well, is there anything, you know, important for observation about, you know, a model of inflation in a certain way? But it changes completely the game, if you want. Once you have a model which does this, normally we say we have the cosmological principle. Right? The cosmological principle says that the universe should be homogeneous and isotropic in large scale. That's usually our starting point. And we assume we have this non-Copernicus Copernican view, where we're not in the center of the universe, right? It's just, it looks isotropic, but from any point. Our point is not special. It's isotropic around us, and it's isotropic around intermedia. So it's isotropic everywhere. So that's the usual cosmological principle, so we all know that. And it's experimentally verified with good precision. Lots of small inhomogeneities, the universe is mostly homogeneous and isotropic. But then usually inflation completely respects this idea. It gives you a very smooth universe. Very smooth and very flat. But then you can get two things. So that's the thing. So you get small inhomogeneities, are predicted also from inflation. So those are the ones you've seen. Water curvature perturbation, which I didn't know is zeta, on order 10 to minus 5. And these have been seen experimentally. And this is on sub-Hubble scale. So this is in our universe. And inside of our horizon, we see small perturbations which have been detected and which are predicted by inflation, and which have led up to now to two nodal pies, or COBE and WMAP. But these are, you know, the well-known perturbations in our universe. But it also predicts, at least if this regime is available to you, it also predicts a very large energy of these on super rods.
Wait, did you just give a number pi to that
one? Yeah, but you got a number pi? No, that's fine. So, Kobe was 2. Oh, sorry. Ben Zeston was sent, then Kobe. There was 2 Nobel Prize. No, we have to get one.
More than that.
Really, yeah. But it was 2 Nobels. I didn't say which one. I didn't write which one. Yeah, and so super level scale. So sub level scale means that k is less than 8h, so moving momentum. And then on super level scale, very, very large in the 1.2s. And then the idea is that this completely breaks this principle. This is saying that if you go on super level scale, the universe is not, it's just really like, essentially it's a fractal. It's completely as inhomogeneous as you could make it.
And those come from the like primordial perturbation before.
Yeah, they still come from the, but the point is that the structure, the global structure becomes very complicated because you start getting large fluctuations everywhere. And the universe keeps re-eating at some places and not re-eating, and then you get a very complex structure. Yeah, and that's why we're going to try to describe this. What is this global picture of inflation, of eternal inflation? But it doesn't look anywhere close to something that's homogeneous but small perturbation, which is what usually we see in our universe. Yes. And the other thing it does, and this is where there's been a lot of questions, is it might change the way you want to do physics, in the sense that if you accept this consequence of inflation, if this is possible, eternal inflation is possible and you can get these really large, what it tells you also is that the value of some parameters, or the laws, even the laws of physics, can be stochastically determined. That is, on large scale, the universe looks extremely different everywhere, and in some places, the laws of physics are different in the sense that they might be mixed before, so EM is the photon is massive or something. So the laws of physics may be different, and the parameters in the theory can vary stochastically in this huge global universe. You can have like the cosmological constant can vary in different places. You can even have some part of the universe which could be five-dimensional, some of the parts which are four-dimensional, some parts are disconnected from others. So this actually, and here, so this of course there is a lot of discussion. You go with the entropic principle and how do you set x, or you know, how do you predict anything if you have a theory that gives you this? And this is one of the reasons also this prediction or this consequence of inflation, one of the reasons that some people actually want to throw inflation away just because of that. Because if that's true, if eternal inflation is true, and if it's true that a lot of the parameters are determined stochastically, then really that's a really big change in how you do physics. And that's why in some sense it's like, again, it's like the Copernicus revolution. So it's now saying, instead of saying we're not special, there are laws of physics and anything special. You know, there's different laws of physics everywhere. So not only your position in the universe is not special, the fact that you have QED is not really special because you could have another part of the universe where there's no interference. All right, so that's the introduction. But there's also, and this leads to the famous measure problem. So, okay, well, if you want to do physics this way, people have tried to predict what's the probability of saying adding a value for a parameter over another, and it's really a tricky question. So, but I would like to spend most of my time in very conventional physics, and so not go into this new kind of physics, like doing physics this way, I'm going to do normal physics. So I'm going to assume the laws of physics and I'm going to go with them. But yeah, I'll come in a little bit. All right. So any question on the general picture? So I'm going to talk about the first. I'm going to introduce the stochastic or random walk type of internalization. Which is sort of the simplest view to describe. And I'll discuss the tunneling. This is the CDL instant tunnel, based on the CDL instant tunnel, which is Kuhlman literature. And then we'll talk about possible observations, so possible tests. And so here, this is where conventional physics. Okay, so let's say there is a regime of internalization. Can we tell? And which way do we go about to tell that? And then the last one, I'll talk about the natural problem. And here I haven't, well, most of this I haven't done any research on, or so this was an excuse for me to learn about all this stuff. Okay, so let's start with a very specific, let's start with chaotic inflation. This is sort of just as a review also. So in chaotic inflation, I have, so this is the usual, so I'm going to do model inflation with the usual Einstein gravity and just a simple scalar field. And for chaotic inflation, I can take the idea of phi to just be n squared. So I'm not saying this is a particularly nice model inflation, but that's a bad model inflation. And it's simple, so I'm just going to start with that. And yeah, with a potential like this, this is literally just a quadratic potential. It's easy to solve the equations of motion. We usually do the usual Sorel approximation, where in the regime where the speed is very small compared to potential, and the variation of the acceleration is very small compared to B prime, then this usual Sorel approximation, the equation of motion is just a Friedman equation. The Einstein equation just reduces to h squared is b over 3, and bang, over that 1, and then 2, pi dot 3h minus b prime.
Is that quadratic potential actually consistent with Sorel?
Yeah. So then the epsilon parameter. Doesn't seem like it's going to be Sorel, right? Because it's a least key. But the epsilon, which is what you need for Sorel, you need epsilon less than 1, is minus h dot over h squared. And so for this model we have, you can solve all these equations, this potential up there. And you'll see what the condition I need as Sorel. So you need h m phi or m Planck. And to me, you not care about the coefficient number 1 or order 1 coefficient. So h is this. Phi dot is minus roughly m Planck. And epsilon, which is minus h over phi dot, or minus h dot over h squared, can show that these are the same, is just 2 squared. This is the so essentially it's v over v prime. V prime over v squared. And so it goes as 1 over 5. So as long as you make phi high enough in Planck union, then you can make this guy essentially Sorel. So in my graph here, it's like this needs to be ordered 10 minus 2 in this model, which means phi has to be over 10. So if I have here, it's going to be 10, 10, 10, state regime. So if you're going and you're in this regime, then epsilon is over 10 minus 2, and you're good. And this is conditionally dependent on what the mass is. So the mass cancels in this calculation. So yeah, so this is the kinetic notation. It's criticized in many, many ways because it's hard to, this is one of the nice ones because, well, you can see it as nice or bad. I think it's nice that because you need to control the potential over Plankian distance, then this is a kinetic notation, in my opinion, only makes sense if you have control over the Plankian correction to your action. So this was an ordinary action that did not include Planck suppressive operators. That would come if you had a full theory of quantum gravity. And these operators would be important if I live in this order. So kinetic inflation is one of those models which you should really do like in string theory or quantum gravity, because you're really sensitive to Planck direction. You have like Planck distance in field space. But for the moment, I'm just gonna assume that you can do it. You can go to this point, and the potential is in for a flat square. There's no correction that coming from quantum gravity or string theory that would spoil that dimension. Okay. So these are essentially, you can solve epsilon is just goes 1 over pi square. And so if you have a model like this of inflation, then the field phi is going, it has some position of this order, and it's decreasing with a constant velocity. See, the velocity is not depending on where you are. So it's a constant velocity, so it's just going down. And at some point, you will reach a point where epsilon is of order 1. And at that point, the universe stops accelerating, and you re-e, and then you're going fast, and you re-e. This is the picture in that model. Okay. You're just going down with potential, so I'm good. You will, as you're going down, you're receiving some small perturbation, which of order h over 2 pi. So this is the quantum jumps you're receiving. This is the jump and the value of the phi. This is for over time, 1 over h. So over 1 level time, your field is receiving some quantum jumps of this order. And this generates curvature perturbation, zeta. Again, so zeta. Is this what you've been using, zeta? Or you've been using r? Zeta? Yeah, zeta is my definition is as this. So I'm assuming a Fardolio universe, and then that's the emergence background, and it has perturbation on top. So zeta is this. And you expand for small z. And so perturbation in the field phi perturbs the energy. Einstein's equation is you're perturbing the energy, you're perturbing the metric. So delta phi directly gives you a zeta perturbation in the curvature. And that perturbation is just delta phi minus h on the side. Which, again, oh, what am I? That's quite wrong. Phi dot square h square minus. So this is delta phi over square root of 2 epsilon. When you rewrite each of the phi in terms of epsilon. Sorry about that. Okay. Right, and then we have the usual power spectrum. This is just review setting up the my notation. So zeta square is going to be h squared roughly equal to epsilon. So zeta is measurements. Okay. And this is what we measure to be of order 10 to the minus 9. Okay. So we're not really measuring h or epsilon, we're just measuring this ratio. And then I'm going to often call zeta to be just the variance. And that's roughly h over epsilon. And that's not planning. It's also the size of the perturbation in our universe, delta rho over. Yeah. Right. So now the concept of general inflation is the idea that there could be a regime here where the quantum jumps are just as big as the classical motion. If that was to happen, then you will never actually go down on average, because your quantum jump will keep you up. So if it's just classical physics, then you have to go down. Conservation of energy. You have to go down and you have to do that everywhere. But because you have quantum jumps, it could be that somehow the quantum jumps are big enough that on average you're not going down, essentially. And you never read. Okay. And so if you look at the quantum jumps are order of h over 2 pi, the classical motion, delta phi, is phi dot times delta t, which is so this is again, this is over a time order bubble. So this is a quantum jump you receive over a Hubble time. So you wait a Hubble time, you receive this jump. The classical motion over the same time is phi dot over h. And so the idea is when these two are roughly equal, you're eternally inflating. So, and you can see that this is just essentially the ratio of these two. Delta phi or delta phi is quantum or classical is just what is curvature changing. So delta phi is up to the solid. It's curvature changing. So the regime of eternal inflation is when the quantum jumps are the same size as the classical jumps. And so that the regime of eternal inflation is when zeta is 1. That's the main point of this. So eternal inflation of the stochastic type. And we say stochastic because what's happening is there's nothing, this guy is just moving around, but he's receiving some random jumps all the time. And so it doesn't, so when delta phi is ordered, phi dot delta t, so when zeta is over 1, then you're generating. Yes?
This oscillation will be amplified.
Well, what, sorry?
This oscillation will be amplified. It goes down and.
Right, so there will be region.
Energy dissipation, or it just.
Right, so there will be region where sometimes you go. So the idea is to have the z over 1, you'll have to be higher in the potential. Essentially, you have to be around 100 in Planck. So if you're 100 in Planck, then your jumps are bigger, and epsilon, essentially, epsilon is smaller, so the curvature perturbation grows. And then you stay here, but sometimes you'll go down, you'll make a jump, random jump, to this point, where now you will go all the way down and beat. Versus some other times, you'll jump up and you'll stay. So there will be parts which will always inflate, but there will be some parts which just ends and we eat. So you get
So if you're still even higher than that means that the quantum is way more
that's right. Significant. Yeah, and then, so even this, yeah, and then you get into a problem is how do you trust, this calculation was a perturbative calculation. What Adrian did, was to expand this in perturbation and write the sort of the quadratic, the free field action for this and so on. But this guy has interactions, and so if you make it really big, at some point you will perturbation can be worked out. And in fact, this should be really sounds weird. I'm talking about having curvature perturbation of order 1. How is it that I can trust my perturbative analysis?
Actually, you can say even more simply though, right, that if the potential energy is greater than M Planck, like you're limited. You
can
say there's a limit on field range just because you're limited by the
consistency. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a back. Well, actually, I'll go to it. Since it's not very long, I'll go to the back reaction. But yes, indeed, there's a point also in the potential where if phi is so big that m squared phi squared is greater than m Planck 4, then you have a real problem. Because then your energy density is greater than m Planck. Really, you should trust. But yeah, this doesn't seem very trustable. And in fact, so the usual procedure is if I write this action here and I can expand it in terms of in perturbation. So this is zeroth order in zeta, first order in zeta, and say second order and third order. So this is an expansion, and so zeta to the zero,
that don't work.
So this is the background. This has no perturbation in it. This is the we're assuming that it's inflating. So the background is smooth, and it's just the potential section. It's potential energy V of phi, which is by the Freeman equation, just h squared. Okay. Right, so this is this that equation there. So that's the background. This is the, when you extend the action to first order, this is going to vanish once you apply the equation of motion, usual argument, that the action is there. For a classical solution, the action is a next criminal. And then this is the quadratic piece, which for the zeta perturbation is just, I'm trying to get my epsilon right. Epsilon zeta dot squared plus minus 8. This is the quadratic part of the action, so it's 4x. So the way to obtain this, I don't know if you said in this form, but this is just extending the Einstein tensors, the Ricci. And then you have to apply the momentum and the Newton constraint. GR is always messy a bit, but not so hard to obtain. And then you have a lot of interaction terms, which are always neglected. So this is the only thing you need if you want to calculate the power spectrum. But if you want to say get the pi spectrum, or if you want to get the two point here, which roughly you can look at a term and it goes like, say, A instead of. Plus many other terms. This will be an example of an interaction. So the only point is that, okay, so it seems like perturbation theory or something should break down here, but you can check that this guy, the energy here, roughly, or the size of these terms, is essentially of the order h to the 4. Okay, the way you do this is you just take zeta is of order this. That's the variance. And that's over a time scale over a bubble and over a distance. That's order bubble. I would like appropriate scale factor used to moving units versus one. But anyway, so this guy, if you over a time scale over a bubble and a time scale and a distance or over a bubble again, then it's just over h.
You can put the implied squared out in front, maybe, just so people already knows.
Oh yeah. Dimension needs to work. Right, so you just essentially the derivative d dt is going to be over h, and zeta is over h over n things square root of epsilon. So you just plug that in here, and you'll find that this goes like h to the 4 times the a cube, which is always there. And this one goes like, it's also a cube, of course. This is the potential, and the action is d4x, aq, d5. Okay. So up to the aqs are everywhere. The point is that it scales like h to 4. And so demanding that, for example, that the back reaction is small compared to this, just means h to 4 should be much less than h squared and n squared, which is satisfied as long as h is less than. So this is the usual requirement that the Abel scale should be less than Planck. Otherwise, the kinetic energy in the perturbation is going to be bigger than the background.
Do you have anything that
went
before that
epsilon
is, if it's
a order
of epsilon?
What am I
breaking? I'm saying you don't even need to reach that the potential doesn't become super Planck.
That's the whole point I'm trying to say, is that we're not going to reach this regime before this is, before we eternal inflate. So the eternal inflation is actually, as far as we can tell here, in a regime of parameter space which is under control. So yes, so this is the condition for the back reaction to be fine, and I can have zeta over one, and h be less than Planck, no problem. The interactions now go like h5 epsilon or m. This guy goes like h to the 4. This guy goes like this. So demanding that this is less, demanding that the perturbation theory is good, demanding that this is less than this, actually gives you another bound. Demanding that the theory is perturbative, if roughly, this is all, of course, order of magnitude, and again, I have my EQ. So it's going to be good if, and the 1/2. So you can see there's a 1/2 because there's 3 zetas, and each zeta comes with a square root of 1/2. So you get epsilon squared divided by epsilon squared 3/2. So this goes like epsilon squared 1/2. But then this is just, so epsilon to 1/2, h5 over n tank, needs to be less than h4. So this is just the same as saying that h over n tank, square root of epsilon, should be less than, okay, so which means zeta should be less than 1/2. So perturbation theory is going to be good as long as zeta is less than 1 or epsilon. But epsilon is less than 1, so this is, that means the 1 is up. So even though you have order 1 curvature perturbation, you can still stress perturbation theory, and you still have a good back edge. Now the point though is in internal inflation, you know you're going to have, as soon as you enter the internal inflating regime, you get everything. Because then the universe becomes infinite, and if you wait long enough, you're going to get every single possible thing that can be realized. It's going to be realized. And so in particular, you'll have region of space where zeta is much bigger than epsilon. These regions are legitimate region where there are points where perturbation theory breaks down, universe is carbon coupled, and probably maybe inflation stops, but we don't really know. So these are regions where your analysis breaks down. But they will still be regions which are eternally inflating, but zeta is less than this, and you have free control. Okay. Right, so this is the rough picture. Now, let's try to be a little bit more precise how you can describe stochastic. So one step which I'm just going to mention is that whenever we do, and all of the argument, you may have been bothered or not by the fact that I always talk about quantum perturbation, but I sort of treat them classically. So there's this problem, which is actually kind of tricky, which is, I don't even know if that's a word, classicalization, decoherence, whatnot. So the fact that really we're talking about delta phi squared, so this is seen as a stochastic random variable of a classical field. So I'm going to want to think of this as stochastic and classical field. But we compute this originally by computing a quantum expectation value of some operator. Which, as you can see, I've never wrote any operator yet, or an relation. This is how originally this is done. Like, you calculate, you expand the field for your modes, you have some annihilation and creation operator. And you calculate this, and then you say, when the perturbation leaves the horizon, so for modes that are greater than the horizon, then the amplitude of the perturbation stays fixed, and it freezes out, and then you can think of it as it's a classical situation. Well, this argument is, you have to, you can make it quantify and show how you can think of this as a classical perturbation and then do it originally as a quantum perturbation. And I think there's many different ways to show this, and it's a bit tricky and it's still ongoing research, I guess. But right here, I'm just going to assume that it's classical, essentially. When, since we're all always dealing in general relation with super bubble nodes, so with perturbations whose wavelength is larger than the size of the horizon, then we always keep the field in classical, even though the origin distance is from those. Yeah, I think right. So you're saying Andrew, right, give a class at psi, where you want to do this? Interesting. I don't see this very done much anywhere in gene cosmology. It's just
pushing under the rug. Is a vacuum quantum?
That's right. So that's a good question. The vacuum, well, there's many different choices you can take the vacuum. And it's a choice. And so usually the one that gives the value that I've been hearing here is the bunch of these vacuum. Which is, so because you're in a, so in Minkowski, I think the vacuum essentially, so in an infinite universe, there's many different ways you can try to define what the in state of the vacuum is. And you're trying to define the one that, well, reproduce Minkowski for really short distance and minimize or, you know, doesn't have as much particle in it or energy, try to minimize.
So it doesn't have any particles in it.
Yeah, it doesn't have any particle, at least. That was a tricky statement. Yeah. It doesn't have any particle if you're moving. Because the problem with particles is vacuum. If you accelerate, you'll see particles. And then there's nothing. But I think if you're not accelerating, there's no particle in this one. But that's in coordinates. So, forget it. The notion of particles is always tricky. The bunch of these vacuum is actually how I know it's defined. If you take this Earth, which is a perfect thing, space time, and you just go to the Euclidean space, and then you have just one, the S force, which is just a force sphere. Then you define the vacuum there that has that respects all the symmetry of the force sphere, and then you end up kind of continuing. And that's defined as the Euclidean vacuum, a bunch of these vacuums.
So the character is not necessarily zero.
Character is not zero. No. Okay. This is a bunch of these vacuum is for yes, but it's zero. So this is not Minkowski.
Right.
It's bunch of these. It has to be at least bunch of these. So it has mode, the mode functions, which are like the angular function, like h tree has partial h tree. Does it recognize this? Okay. Now this could be a class on its own. It's a very good people working here on this, but what happens if you change the vacuum on the prediction limitation? Because we don't really know what the vacuum was. But yeah, in this talk, I would just assume a bunch of these vacuum. The traditional one is just this. Okay, so then the idea, so once we have classicalization, so assuming that the field is classical on super hollow scale, then we'll just, I'm just going to define phi to be a classical value of the field. I need to average it, really. So the idea is that I need to coarse grain over bubble size. I need to average the field by integrating some window function. And this is supposed to be average over size, or greater than 1 over O. This is coarse grain. Over size delta x greater than 1 over h, I probably need step vector. Since I'm always going to work with the, essentially I'm always working with the usual metric. Because of this a, yes, but anyway. So over scale, over some size, you need to have a window function, which is going to average over that size. And then the idea, then you can sort of course marrying sort of like just, you know, forgetting about the atom, just saying the position of the field in the universe and forgetting that it's very homogeneous and it's quantum on some level scale, just averaging over some super level scale. Yeah. And then I see this fantastically, so in the square world is gonna have spatial motion, which should just be phi dot is equal to some function of phi, and then there will be a noise coming from the quantum field. And the noise function of space and time. And so the idea is that I have a classical field which is having a drift, so it's falling down, but there's also a noise coming from all these quantum perturbations that just keeps bumping this field around. The noise has some correlation function, so I have some statistics. Usually we take the noise to be Gaussian. So the noise is some correlation function, and it's usually assumed to be, well, Gaussian and also to decay for large distances. So between 2 points, the noise should be uncorrelated over large distances. Given a fundamental theory, you can go and compute the noise. And there's a procedure for going to quantum and then doing the coarse graining and calculating exactly what the noise is. Right, and so just going to be some function c p star x star, and it's, yeah. So it's exponentially suppressed, say, for large distances. But for at least today, we'll just always consider phi going on some a single moving word line. Okay. So we always just keep track of phi on some x equal constant. Okay, so this is going to be a single moving word. All right, and then I can take a coincidence limit of this thing. So I can take t equal t tilde and x equal x tilde. And then the c is then just a function of, essentially, it's just a function of t or phi. The other thing is just what I already did before. A squared over. Okay, sorry. So the idea is I have a noise. Normally it's a function of space and distance, and I can't really ask about the correlation between different points. For now, let's just take phi. We're just interested in the same co-moving word line. We're just going to be interested in different time scale. We're just going to keep track of time, and then the noise is h square, and this is what you get over this is h square for delta t over 1 of h, and it's 0, c is equal to 0, delta t greater than 1 of h. Okay, so the noise is a white noise essentially, which is just h square, it's the same for all scale. But then for time scale greater than 1 over h, you get no effect. So you only do you have a field which is drifting, but it's adding a noise that's kicking in, and it's only sensitive to a time, you know, 1 over h before it's receiving kicks of this order. So this is a simple-minded model to capture a stochastic process that's going on during internal
fusion. Noise is just some flux.
Yeah, it's just like, this is sort of to parameterize the effect of quantum jumps. Not here, but the effects of quantum jumps over the classical function. So I'm going around, so normally I would go down, sort of always conserving energy, but it could be a noise that kicks me back up. And so, and the noise, so it's just passing correlation function, so sometimes it's small, sometimes it's big, it's just stochastic variable. Okay? Right. You can write this.
And it always kicks you back up, right? It never brings you down.
No, it can bring you down.
Yes. From stochastical methods, I understood that a white noise is a noise that goes in a large variety of wavelengths, and and frequencies, and I understood that for inflations there was a specific range of wavelengths where the fluctuation could affect and produce this inflation. Is this really a white noise? Because
It's probably not actually really a white noise. I do have to assume that it's over super old scale, but it is the amplitudes. It's delta 5. Put this here. Yes, my delta 5 is really h squared over 2 pi squared. And this is for, there should be some scale k, and this is supposed to be essentially the same quality. But it's not truly, first of all, because there's going to be some scale dependence. So it's not true that they all see the same page. So yes, it's not completely. Although I think, can you have a white noise here? No, yeah. You can have a white noise with
With the white noise, but with an extra delta function that sets a limit to enroll us a series of frequencies of wavelengths specific.
Yeah.
So I understood that this white noise was a series of delta, and one more that will complete the whole set of frequencies that you require for.
That's right. Now you can do not. Yeah. Yeah, it is definitely a first level approximation to just take it for white noise, but then you can be better in. And also, we are neglecting the interaction, so it's supposed to be Gaussian. If it's really, it should have some small level of non Gaussianity, then it's no really longer a white noise. Good. Any other questions? Right, and so, yeah, so this equation also can be rewritten. Let me just write it down just to see. So you can write it as just as a difference equation between two times, say, order h, since the noise is only acting over that time, say, order h, then delta 5 from phi t plus alpha t plus phi of t is going to be the drift of phi times delta t. And then this noise is usually written as a diffusion coefficient, 2 d of phi delta t times, and then this is, c of t is, again, a white noise, but this time it's normalized to 1. So the variance is 1. So c squared c, that's it. And then this is called the drift, and it's going to depend on the fundamental theory, so you have to keep in what your potential is. So this is the drift, and that's the diffusion coefficient, the diffusion function, which for this model, for a Searle model, anyway, if I take the C to be of this order, then the diffusion coefficient, the diffusion function, is h cubed essentially. So then you write b of phi is h cubed. Alright, so again, so there's nothing really deep here. The point again is this is the Langevin equation. So we have to write this down. And so the idea is, yeah, okay, well, we can assume that the field is classical, and we can describe it for the noise. And that's, okay, so that's the one which is, like, the most intuitive. But that's not what people usually work with. And it's the same as in statistical mechanics. Usually you can work with the Fokker-Planck equation, the well-known step to go from algebra to the Fokker-Planck equation. And so I will define p phi of t to be the probability of adding phi at time t at a given point x. I'm a single commoving word line. So this is commoving probability density. So it's really going to be better just, okay, you're going on this line, what's the probability of adding phi at this time? So you can go each time and ask, now what is the probability of adding phi? OK? because if receiving quantum jumps and so forth, and it's having a drift, so at any given time, you'll have some probability of firing in time. You can rephrase this as saying, what is a fraction of total volume? And that's the way usually people work with it. Where phi of total volume that has phi, that is where the field phi is this particular value. Maybe I should call this a gliding phi, means that the scalar field has some numerical value phi, bar, whatever, some value phi. Sorry, I'll call it phi. Okay, but it just means the scalar field has some specific value at t. Okay, so that's a fraction of total volume, but there it's commuting. The volume is measured in, and this is a tree volume, and it's measured the commuting coordinates, x. Yes. Okay. So the commuting volume actually is decreasing, even during internal rotation. If you ask at the end of internal rotation, what's the probability of having phi that's not in the read, so in other words, to find a spot which has not a flake of signal, then it's going to go to zero. The commuting volume is decreasing. What's increasing is the physical volume when you include that A. So there's another probability, which is PV. It's the same thing, except that instead of measuring which the commuting coordinates, you're measuring the physical coordinates. So you have A cubed there. So this is the volume weighted. And both of them, yeah.
So just, you mean that the probability that phi has a special magnitude is the same as the volume that the eternal inflation occurred?
Right, so these two statements is, essentially the probability of having phi, a specific essentially you think of this as, I have my stating volume and I'm just taking a slice t. So I'm moving like this, and phi is fluctuating, having different values. On a single line, I can ask, what's the probability that phi has a value phi naught at this time? Okay, so I do the slice, and that's what it's probability of. On my line, which I randomly chose, one line, what's the value that phi has? I can also say, well, don't just look at this one line. Look at the whole thing. How many lines have phi multiplied? That's the same as probability of having phi naught on the line. That here. Mm-hmm. So if I ask, look at the whole line here and I ask, phi naught here is like, let's say the line everywhere here is phi naught and here is like phi one. So there will be a chance that half of the volume will have phi naught. So if I take a randomly chosen line, I have probability one half, that I will have phi naught, so probability one half, I will have phi one. So this is why these probabilities. So you can think of it as probability of having phi naught on your line at a given time, or you can think of it as a fraction of the whole volume here of spaces where phi is not at that time.
But then some values of phi correspond to the internally inflating regime, and some don't. So you're going to get a volume.
Right. And so the interesting question is like, what's the fraction of the total volume which has phi equal to the reheating value? So there will be a value of phi, where epsilon equals 1, right? That value of phi, you're sure you're done, inflation rates. So you can ask, how much of the total volume is reheating? That will be the fraction of total fraction of total volume where phi equals phi star, the value for the reheating surface, on the reheating surface. Right, and then, so this probability, you can, there's a usual step to go from the other line, for a stochastic process, let's describe it as modular equation, to go to the Fokker-Planck equation. And that equation, it's just, I'm not going to do this step, but you can look at it. And also, there's some ambiguity when you go to the Fokker-Planck equation. It's sort of ordering ambiguity. But anyway, so this is the Fokker-Planck equation, which describes how the probability distribution evolved in time, given the drift and the diffusion function, which you need to give in your fundamental theory. Like the drift, for example, the drift is really just a function of the quantum jumps, but it will depend, for example, if you have some bunch degrees or not. Then the quantum jumps, the vacuum, since you change the vacuum, the fusion coefficient will change. So there's a bit, you know, everywhere here there's a model dependence. Now this equation is variable for some reason. And great products. It's the worst thing about it is that it's gauge dependent in the sense that it depends on what your definition of a point. So if you choose different slicing for what you call time, then the equation didn't say try to answer a question like the one I was just asking here. I was asking what's the fraction of the total volume where phi is equal to phi naught. That's a time slicing that I chose, which is so important. If I choose a different coordinate, the answer is different. That's really annoying because then it shouldn't be in the coordinate. So, yeah. So the FP equation, so Parker Tank equation, is gauge dependent. So there's not that many things that you can get out of it that's meaningful. There are a couple of things, but a lot of things are really, you get an answer and then you choose a different slicing for your time and you get a different answer. And yeah, there's not much you can say. There's a couple of things you can answer, you can say that are not gauge dependent. One is whether you even just have the presence of internal inflation. This is a question that's sort of a binary question, which can be answered and does not depend on how you slice. The fractal dimension. Sounds pretty great. So the reason why there's a fractal dimension, the reason why this is really emerging is actually not that hard. So let's say I start with my spacetime, okay? And it's internally inflating, and every time it ends, it reheats, it will say, let's say it reheats to Minkowski. So Minkowski, so this is a sort of a Penrose diagram. If I have a Minkowski spacetime, I have an old diamond, right? So my Minkowski spacetime is this, and the Penrose diagram. So, and the sitter, so this is Minkowski, the sitter is a square. Okay, so the only thing that you remember from these Penrose diagram is that Minkowski infinity is null, two null thing, and for the sitter, infinity is space like. So this would be a place where the infinity is space like, so you're in the sitter, so this is your Minkowski. So the space of looks like this, you know. My rendition, original rendition. So a bunch of places you reheat it to some Minkowski universe. But there's still some places where you're inflating and you're in the center. This we define the what's interesting is okay, what is the space that's still inflating? So you can define a word line, say P, and make a set of all the word lines which are not reheating. And it turns out that set is a set of measure zero. So most, again, if you take a random word line, it reheats the quality one. But there are some lines in there which never reheats. That's the definition of internalization. So they just go on. This is literally. So this is not a fixed line here. This is a Penrose diagram. So this is T equal plus infinity. I'm literally at the end here. So there are some line where you still read. And the reason why it's a fractal is because if you start with a patch where the value of the field is finite, and then this patch, if you let it go, it gives internal inflation and it gives you the set E of all these curves that don't repeat. So this is the all these points here, I'll put them together and that's going to be my manifold, which doesn't repeat. It turns out you can show that there will always be a point where you will get back again, find out. You get back again your exact initial condition that you started. So you start with some initial condition, you generate a set of things that internally inflate. If you wait long enough, you will regenerate your initial condition, which will regenerate your set. So there will be some other time t where you will reach exactly the same initial condition that you have. And then you will regenerate the same set of the generally taken trajectory that you have. So the set is a subset of itself, and that's sort of like what you expect from fractals. You keep generating yourself. And it has some dimension. In the middle of the set of zero, you can calculate the dimension, and that's a given thing you can do, which is, I haven't found any meaning to it. Yeah, was it good for it? I don't know. But if you want, you can calculate it. I've never seen any use for it, but.
So what did you say? What is this fractal dimension?
I can show you what it is. I cannot calculate it. But you mean the definition?
No, 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 no. The
value?
The value.
It depends on the model. But you can obtain it. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a function of this BFI. And the idea is you can use this equation, even though it's gauge dependent. You can, in a specific gauge, the answer you get for the fractal dimension is the correct one.
But so in the model that you're showing here, about.
That would be a good question. What is it? I don't know. That's a good question. Right. I think you have to think of this as a set of lines. So this would be normally, if it wasn't fractal, it would be dimension one. So it's really just lines. But I think it's slightly less than one.
Slightly less or more?
I think it's less.
I think it's more.
What could it be less?
To be less true,
less like all strings. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I guess so.
But
no, you're right. I think it is. Because it's the exponent of the. Oh, I guess that's correct. Yeah.
But it doesn't seem, I mean, nobody found anything interesting by comparing fractal dimensions or anything.
Maybe there's something interesting. In fact, I can just tell you what the way to get this is to solve the Fokker-Planck equations for the way you solve this often is you write this and this solve it for the volume weighted, which is the more useful. Well, you can solve it for both. So if you solve it for the co-moving one, you can write it as some late time, how do I call it? You can write it as some over lambda is p lambda phi times e minus lambda. Essentially, you solve it as eigenvalues and exponential in time. And then you're trying to find the one that grows, the one that decreases. But the biggest eigenvalue, so you can show for p of phi and t, the solution to this, completely generally, can show that some eigenvalue gamma, where gamma is less than 0. Which means, gamma is greater. So this guy always decreases exponentially. But if you look for PV of phi, so the volume, not the co-moving volume, the real volume, then you can either have, and there's no proof of either, you can either have gamma tilde less or gamma tilde greater than 0. When it's less than 0, that's a case where you have a system which is generally failing. When it's greater than 0, then it's not. And this gamma tilde essentially turns out to be just your fractal dimension. What gauge? By gauge, I mean choice of time. So this is the gauge over the diffeomorphism group. Okay, so let me move on to the second part. Okay, so I'll come back a bit to that property function when I talk a bit about the measure. But now let's move on to the second type of model running thing, which is bubble notation. This is the one that we, in the context of the landscape, you may have heard more about. The idea is if I have a potential, say for phi, BFI, with two minima, phi plus and phi minus, then I can tunnel. Say this is a false vacuum, so I can tunnel here. Quantum mechanics can do that. So if I start with a spacetime where I'm in the plus back here, then I can create randomly quantum fluctuation and create a bubble where inside is the minus vector, and I have some domain walls occurring in the two regions. And the bubble grows at the speed of light, so the thing's expanding, until eventually everything's in the minus vector. So that's just, yeah. So this is just bubble nucleation. It's a first order phase transition. It occurs, and we've seen this in nature many times. And the idea is that this could occur also with the vacuum itself. And if it does, if you start with a theory which has a cosmological constant greater than zero, where, so say, the potential is higher than zero. If you start with some cosmological constant and you stay there long enough, you'll be inflated. This was the original model of Schumacher. And in fact, the reason why it was thrown away was because this model does not repeat exactly the way it defines that. In general, you'll tunnel, but you don't tunnel fast enough. The reheating region don't percolate. So you tunnel once in a while, you have a problem with tunneling. And you tunnel, but you still the different bubbles of reheating universe. You get another one here, and you don't collide. And so the universe never fully reheats, and you always have regions which are safe. So that's another way to get internalization. And that's actually how it's very generic. You have to tunnel very fast in order not to for the bubbles to have time to meet. You have to have a very high probability of decaying. And if you have a very high probability of decaying, then you don't stay there very much, and you cannot get there enough. It's default for inflation. So that's why this, as a model of inflation, this is completely ruled out to explain what we see in the universe. But it could be that there was a period where the universe was in a situation like this, in which case it's almost guaranteed to be an internal inflation. Again, you really need, and this is true also for this regime here, is that you can have a region of internal inflation, but you will have to go through the point where we reproduce our universe. You have to go to a region where we have a normal inflation. So this is the same thing here. So I could have a model like this, where I tunnel from here to here, and then here I do normals for all. Or I tunnel to my chaotic model in the right part. Right. So the interesting question, so then this tunneling in vacuum was done in this paper by Coleman and Lucia, which I absolutely need to read you part of, because it's so great. So this paper, which I read here, at the end, so they do a great job, but at the end they describe that the possibility that we're living in a false vacuum has never been a cheering one to contemplate. It's the ultimate ecological catastrophe. It's a new vacuum, there are new constant of nature. And after vacuum decay, not only is black as we know it impossible. So it's the mystery of reality. So, but however, one can always draw stark comfort from the possibility that perhaps, in the course of time, the new vacuum will sustain, if not light as we know it, at least some structures capable of knowing joy. This possibility has now been eliminated. But you want to read this paper? So they eliminate, so they calculate, this is a great paper which calculates first the vacuum in the can, the possibility of decaying vacuum. And they show that if you decay to ABS, you will crunch and you will not exist, which is what this paper is about. And what's great about this paper, too, is that as a physics thing to learn, is that it's so great to see how they completely assume that lambda was zero. The only thing we could decay to is ABS, because it was so obvious to everybody back then that there was no cosmological constant. And so now this last paragraph is no longer true, because while we could decay today, and it would be a pretty big ecological catastrophe, we would not necessarily decay to ABS. So it could be that, and structure capable of knowing joy would eventually exist. So anyway, so the way to calculate this instanton is we talk about a topology of decay per unit of time per unit of volume. And that's usually just parameterized this time. So it's a a quantum process, so I put my h bar back to the long, and it's exponentially suppressed. So this is so I'm not going to review this too much. This is a sort of standard instanton calculation. Unfortunately, I'm not going to care about this guy, which is hard to calculate. But there's some good techniques to calculate this one, which is the most important one. And so let me just review that quickly. Because, yeah. Okay, so, yeah, so you can compute. So have you seen, anybody seen this instanton type of calculation? So the idea, if I want to calculate a bound, it's just a technique, essentially, and I really, Coleman's book described this very nice. But the technique to calculate this is called just the bounds, and the approximation that's often done is a Tien-Wall approximation. And the idea is that reverse potential. So my potential, which was like this, I go to Euclidean space. So I just, instead of adding an action test, I go to Euclidean. And then and effectively what that does is just a reversal potential. Plus minus. Now it's 5 minus. Plus. And then in that reverted potential, you calculate the bounds, which is a solution that goes from here to here. So it's called a bound solution. You just solve the equation of motion for that solution, and that's called phi. And then the idea to calculate the bounds is you just calculate b, this coefficient is given by the value of the Euclidean action evaluated at the bounds minus the Euclidean action evaluated outside the bubble. So usually that's zero. So it's really, usually that's zero, so it's just the Euclidean action. And the idea is you minimize it, because it could be different solutions, you minimize that. So you want the bounds, which gives you the smallest b. Because bounds which are bigger b, you don't care, because they're going to be even more exponential suppressed. So that's the usual technique. You minimize this or whatever. If you have many solutions, you minimize, you find the solution, and minimize this. So to give you a flavor of what this looks like, so usually symmetry is very important. You know in advance that what's going to be minimizing this b is going to be what's the most symmetric. And so if you take the symmetry, and this is going to come again. So this is an Euclidean space, now it's four-dimensional. So the most symmetric bounds is going to be 0,4 symmetric, so it's just going to be on the scale. So phi is only going to be a function of, say, rho, my radial point. So rho squared, sum over I for 1 to 4. Okay, so this is four-dimensional Euclidean space. This is when, so I go to Euclidean space when I do my bounds. Okay. And then, so let's say, for example, so the Tien-Wall approximation is to suppose that the difference in energy between these two guys is very small. So you take, you can take epsilon to be u of phi plus minus u of phi minus, where u again is my potential. So the value of the potential is at the two minima. And we're going to assume that this is very small. And then you can expand in that. And so it's not really necessary, but if you don't do that, then the wall and the bubble is kind of thick, it's kind of hard. The wall is the hardest part to describe.
So pictorially, it just means the place where the energy density changes skinny if you're going to draw them.
Yeah, so exactly. So the solution, let me write. So like for a potential, typical potential, lambda, whatever, pi squared, pi squared. Okay, so this is a typical potential. Now note that this is like this. This is the usual big potential. And now the two things are equal. So this is to u naught. And u is like u naught plus epsilon. So I'm just expanding in epsilon. And say u naught is like this. Then you can solve for phi. And phi is just a tangent, hyperbolic tangent. So it looks like this. by the bound solution, this goes between pi minus to pi plus, and then the thickness, the width of the wall, is set by 1 over mu, essentially. The order is 1. So the idea is that you have a bubble. Inside the bubble, the field value is pi minus. Outside the bubble, the field value is pi plus, and you have a domain wall during the transition between the two. And this is a solution to the equation function for phi with this potential, which is inverted, actually. Okay. Yeah, so I should write it this way. It's the inversion of this potential. Okay. And the idea is that phi also, the solution, is tangent hyperbolic. Proportional to, but then it depends on rho. Yeah, actually, I should follow me.
Sorry, I'm just a little bit confused. It's mu. It's not really like epsilon.
I think you can show that epsilon being small for this potential is going to be a conditional.
Sorry, Bob.
U is just parameter in my potential, so essentially the mass of the field. I should have checked, but I think you're right, it's probably something in this one. I can check.
But yeah, true that mu does define the thickness of your potential in the Higgs potential.
Yeah, is it something like the ratio of mu to epsilon? Actually, no. But it was like the width.
Yeah, the width over the height
should be small compared to this.
Yeah, sorry, I don't want to say any actual number, except the one that I know is correct. I think it's pretty good. Yeah. Right, and so you can calculate B given the solution. By evaluating, so outside, again, you can set it to zero, the action to zero. If you set this potential here, it's going to be at zero. So then outside, B is zero. And then you can calculate B, and it's slightly messy still, even in this approximation because of the wall. But you can calculate B. The thing is that there's also a rho bar right here. That's roughly the radius of the bubble. That's the radius of the bubble here. And that's the thing you're going to minimize about. So when you minimize, you want to find the rho bar such that B is minimized. So when you find B, so say you put B in, you just put this solution back into the action. The bounds is it's pi squared, rho bar to the 4, so it's proportional to the volume times epsilon. This is because you integrate the action into the volume. And then there's another pi squared rho bar q times s1, where s1 is this the wall solution. The integral of pi minus pi plus phi plus 2 mu dot phi minus mu plus. Okay, so you should maybe recognize this like as WKB like looking. So you see that what happens is that you try to minimize the dark section, there's a negative term coming from the negative energy because you're decaying into a false vacuum, you're decaying into the true vacuum, that's lower energy. And then there's a competing term, which is a surface term, which is the energy of the domain wall. So you're trying to cancel a surface against a volume, and so that's why there's different rho dependence, and there's going to be a specific value of rho, which minimizes this. And that's the value at which you're, when you create a bubble, it creates with some radius. And that's the radius it solves. So you tunnel to a bubble and it doesn't have zero radius, it has a radius which solves this equal to zero. minimize, sorry, B parameters. The BP Romar. And then you can add that value of Romar, you can evaluate the radius. So this little procedure gives you Romar, the minimum radius, the radius at which you tunnel, gives you the bounds, which gives you the probability of tunneling. And it also gives you the full solution. Because then when you have the solution in Cartesian, you can just analytically continue to real space by going rho goes to square root of x squared minus t squared. And that just gives you the full real space solution. So this very simple procedure gives you essentially what you need. Very neat. And now, of course, what was a static, completely spherical, instant tunnel with an O4 symmetry, once you do the analytic continuation, it becomes an O3-1 symmetry, and the walls are extended at the speed of light. Are extending at speed of light. So you have ball. And so what it looks like, I draw my consider. So I'm in the false vacuum here. F, then I create a bubble at some radius, and then the wall accelerates until it moves at the speed of light. So the wall is really has energy, so it's never really going at the speed of light. And so it goes to this point. And then this is, say, this is a de Sitter. So then if this is a de Sitter, then this would be a space like infinity. But then this is, say, this is Minkowski, or it's a de Sitter with a smaller cosmological constant. Then this will have a cap on it. If it's exactly Minkowski, I should draw a triangle. If it's just a sphere with a smaller cosmological constant, we'll just draw it as space like again, instead of null, but smaller cosmological constant, so that's a longer. So anyway, so that's my bubble. Usually you'll see people not caring about this part. If you zoom out, this can be written as this. But really, you should always think that this guy here is actually, he doesn't really work. So if you zoom in, this one works. So that's a bubble. And so you're in your false vacuum, you tunnel, you get a bubble. So this was just a scalar field. The only thing you need to do now is also what I have. Gravity, two things are going to happen. One is that the bounds actually changes. And the minimization process changes a little bit. That's because energy changes geometry. So a volume canceling against the surface term, now you're going to get the fact that, say, this is EDS or DS changes this geometry thing. But that's not so important. I mean, it's just changing what the actual value of B is and the actual value of the ball. What's happening when you have gravity is also you're not only solving for phi, but you're also solving for the metric. So you have two equations on phi. So the bounds is a bounds for phi and a bounds for the metric.
So now the gravity of the bar is false and one is important. Right?
So
right, it's not only epsilon that's important.
It's not only epsilon? You mean I don't need to
Well you have a difference of B at far plus and one lines.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also.
Right. Epsilon is the difference between
yeah. Right, but when you have gravity, I'm just saying that the V at far plus and minus is also important.
That's
only the difference.
Oh, that's right. No, that's a good point. So the solution, say in the phi plus region, it's going to be the sitter if V is positive, the sitter like. So the solution, the explicit solution for the metric will depend on what. So in that paper, Cohen, they do two cases, which is one you have the sitter and indicate Minkowski, and the other case is when you have Minkowski and indicate the metric. And yeah, so order. Okay, so right, so the point now is you're solving for the gravitational bounds. Alright, so this looks like this here. So I'm just going to put some metric now, rho c squared, c omega. So this is, you can use, again, the symmetry. You know that this is the normally you have n variables to solve for. We're going to use O4 symmetry to reduce a system of n equations, the gravitational equations, n equations, as a function of four variables to one equation as a function of one variable. So that's a pretty huge simplification that the O4 symmetry gives you. And so you just have to solve, assuming that the n septon is going to have the exactly spherical O4 symmetric, and it's going to have this photometric as its profile. And then what you can solve for this is going to have a zero, very much like this has, and it's going to be an interior and an exterior. The zero of P of C is a coordinate singularity. So it goes to zero, but it's not an actual real singularity because all the fields are goes to zero at the wall. So there's no actual real singularity, but it does delimit the different region of space, and you have to do the analytic equation differently for these different regions. So the main argument that's important to remember, and here it's never really presented, so I actually had a hard time find the thing that would convince me the most and convince you guys the most. So it's really important. The argument is that what's going to be inside the bubble is going to be an open universe with negative curvature. And we should be able to see this just from this. So what's happening is because you have this O4 symmetry, when you're going to energetically continue, has O3-1 symmetry. And essentially, that's the symmetry for hyperbolic space, as opposed to, say, a disintegrated closed universe. So what's happening is that in this metric, C squared here is the radius of a four sphere. So it's 1, 4, 3, 4. And so you can define this space as being a sphere with some radius dependent in R4. And the idea then is when you analytically continue, you should continue this to R3-1, and then C squared is now defined as sum over I of 1 to 3, x 2 minus t squared. So 1 to 4, x i squared again, x squared. Yeah. So the thing is, I just took one of the coordinates in R4 and to continue it. And then, so let's define this guy just now R squared, x t squared. And then the idea is that when C equal to zero, that's exactly the wall. When T, the time is greater than R, so then you're inside the bubble. And so this would be for short radius. And for R much greater than T, you're outside. And the idea is that when you're inside the bubble, you need to continue C, to I, C, because this becomes negative, except C becomes imaginary. And so what's happening is inside the bubble, the metric is going to be minus, that's defining C equals I tau. So then I'm going to have the metric is going to be minus D tau squared plus rho of I tau squared, whatever function this is, didn't specify this. And then what this verbal argument is supposed to show you is that when it was a tree sphere, is now an hyperbola because C squared is by this. And so this is going to go, not only do you need C go to I tau, but this also changes to an hyperbola H. That here, so again, this is related to the symmetry go to 4, 2, 3, 1. The space is always hyperbolic. And depending on what this is, it could be the center and the center or whatnot, but it's always hyperbolic. And so it's always an open universe. Okay. Versus it was flat. Yeah. And so that means also that the curvature is always negative inside the bubble. Outside the bubble, you do the same thing, except that C doesn't have to be is real to start with, so you don't get the minus 10. And on the wall, what do you do on the wall? That's something you can do on the wall. I don't remember. Okay. And so you can, and then you have tree metric, and you can really do the junction. I'm not sure that they all join, so you really have tree region inside the bubble, outside the bubble and then the wall. And you're trying to match all these metrics. It gets quite messy. But the main point is that hyperbolic. And so we have negative. I remind you, maybe in FRW, this is k equal minus 1. So I think it's curvature, which can be rewritten in terms of this hyperbolic trajectory I have. So I'm going to give you. This can be rewritten just as d. Another vernal dr squared plus cinch. So this is a hyperbolic scale. Okay, so an example. So you can solve it in many different instantons. It does depend on the exactly what you were to choose as your initial condition when you start the steering there. But an example is, say we go from Minkowski to empty the sitter. So Minkowski, lambda equals 0. To empty the sitter, lambda is negative. And this is always approximate here. When we say empty the sitter, there's going to be a bunch of, well, that's actually the problem. So then you can show that you can solve for this condition. In the field wall approximation, you can solve for the scalar field, it's going to be roughly just some kind of coming wall. And you can solve also for the verb, the metric. And it's lambda sin h c 1. And so this looks like that has 0, like c equal lambda, like c equals 0. And so yeah, it looks like this. Okay. And it grows, so the metric. Yeah, let's go in. Well, outside is just this square. So inside is just dc square plus rho square d omega t. So this is the metric in Euclidean, which you can see that at least for large, you see it's sort of an exponential. And so this is kind of ADS, a little more effective. Inside the wall, inside the bubble, this metric becomes minus d tau squared. And then you need to add c goes to minus I tau, then this becomes plus lambda squared sine of tau times dh2. Okay. And again, this is some weird way to write ADS in an open, you know, which is again a weird, so slightly different type of ADS you've seen. And what this guy is doing is he's expanding. As tau goes, he expands and then contracts. And expand and contract. So it's big bang, big crush, big bang, big crush, nonstop. It's perfectly fine to decide each time that you hit one of the zeros, you have again a coordinate singularity where this vanishes. Now, the big problem with this is that if you have any perturbations, which we'll have, because this is only sort of approximate, even this self tin wall, this tangent, you know, any perturbations. In the solution. Inside, it's not going to be exactly ABS because there's going to be a little bit of the wall meeting in. You know, this is a complicated system. And so, in general, this equation is not exact. There's a small correction. And then you can show that if any perturbations will make this coordinate singularity into a real spin. So this is actually. Under unstable perturbation. And so these vacua are usually called terminal vacua. And those are the ones that don't have any structure of capable of having choice. These are the doom vacua. Very, very bad. But there's people here trying to, it's a good question where you can balance ADS. Okay. I'm just saying here in general, you don't. So an ADS can just expand and bam, crunch. it's hard. But it could be that you can fine tune your way such that you actually go through. Then there could be something going on in these APIs. But usually what happens if you tunnel through the SQA. And so then we have this picture where it's very much as a stochastic, you randomly sometimes generate a bubble. And probably put my hands. So So you have some bubbles. And you have some bubbles that terminate. These are EDF bubbles, just hang. And nothing happens. You have some places which keeps inflating, and you have some places which ends up in Minkowski. Or you can also just say that it's itself a DF space, and you can have other bubbles inside this. You can have another sitter space here, and you have other bubbles. Which goes to Minkowski and the structure gets really messy. Right, so but it doesn't have to be Minkowski on the part. You can just end to another sitter, and then you have other bubbles inside that other sitter. And so that's the global picture of tunneling type. You have some probability of decay. And of course, the potential is, So the potential, you can do some sum 20 model. So the idea is you can have a really, really complicated potential with many different vectors you can go to. So there's probability to going to every one of them. And then, So now let me, in the last 20 minutes, see, can we observe any of this? The first thing that we could potentially observe would be negative curvature. We know that our universe is flat, so we measure the angles, it adds up to 180, it doesn't. We don't see hyperbolics, we see a fact. It could be that if it has up to less than 180, then we'll see some negative. So the idea, of course, though, is that after we bubble, after we nucleate, there will still be a normal error of inflation, which will erase most probably negative curvature. And so that's the thing. In fact, that's the big flaw of this, is that you have to have normal inflation, and it will probably erase any memory from this time where you were nucleated. And so that's the flow. So there's arguments out there that if you have like a minimum amount of e-fold that you need to get flatness, if you don't have that many e-fold, then you'll be flat up to a small correction, which we can measure. And then the prediction is it will be negative. If you see positive curvature, then we cannot, there's no way in this process anywhere, except maybe the starting point. Well, anyway, that would be weird. It would be, if the starting point is where you need to go to get the positive curvature, then you might as well forget about the compensation, which is supposed to be going on forever. You don't want to go to the starting point. But as soon as you go away from the starting point and you lose memory of what you started with, then you are in a negative curvature space, or that negative curvature. So that's it. So if you see positive curvature, you rule this out. That's good, except that there's a lot of ways to be. Probably there will be no curvature whatsoever. So the other possibilities is bubble collision, which is kind of interesting. So let me try to draw this. It's kind of tricky. couple of things I want to illustrate. Oh, there's something I checked. All right. Okay, so this is two bubbles that collide. This is going to happen. So the frequency at which it's going to happen is a contentious issue, which again goes back to these measure problems. So one of the things I did here is I did a boost. So I choose a time slicing such that the two bubble were created at the same time. You can always do that. You can always just choose a time slicing so that these two guys are at the same time. So I choose a time. So I choose a time such that the two bubbles are at the same time. And then the variable is going to be sort of a distance. When two bubbles collide, you get two things. You get debris, which is nice. So the main wall just sort of disappear into a bunch of stuff. And this bunch of stuff is essentially going in a null direction. It's a null shell of debris. Which sort of, if you get hit by a null shell of debris, it could be coming from this collision back then. And then there's a new dominant wall that separates the two regions, which is the blue line here. And again, it's accelerating which way it bends, sort of depends on the energy. So the solution to this, what you have to do is to solve all of the space-time in different region and match there. You can do the Israel junction matching conditions, try to solve this. It's quite a messy solution, obviously. But you can do this. And then, so then this region is all the sort of the new region that was merged. And then this is this old area. And then if you have an observer, so it could be that an observer first was created here, say a galaxy, and then it moved in. So it could be, first of all, that this part, the universe, is so different from our parts that nothing can be created. That doesn't mean nothing exists here, because it could be that we were created here and then evolved into that region. But they do make a difference in the literature between the native born, the people who were born here, and the foreign born, the people who were born here. So anyway, so this guy is born here, goes here, and then there could be another one. And the point is that, so these surfaces here are surfaces of constant time, so this thing is essentially, well, the center, but sorry, you know, very small constant thing that we have today. And these are surfaces of constant time, and so let's say this is where inflation, so we created, then we went on for a while, we were negative, curvature dominated, then we started the normal era of inflation, then we eat, and then we have, say, the surface of that sky. And that's what we see with the CMB. So we have our observer here, and he sees this back in the past, that's us, we see this light cone, part of which is on the last surface of scattering, part of which, this is also the last surface of scattering, but you can see that it's going to be disturbed in this region. The surface of constant phi, which is how I'm defining my time, is different because the solution for phi is different here. Phi is my scalar field state. So there's going to be slight difference here between the surface around scattering here and here. You can think of it also as the wall comes in with the perturbation. And so maybe we could see this, detect this. If over here, we're not seeing anything. So we have to be in the new region. It's quite, it's pretty far-fetched. I don't know what people. But yes, the idea would be that there's a bubble collided with us, and you can see it in the CMB. You can think of this as this is a time coordinate, and say this is an angular coordinate, and there's an S2 on the wall. And so you can think of this my coordinate is 0 to pi. This is my psi coordinate, and then I'm here, and I'm saying that half of the wall, say, this is the surface of that scattering, and say half of it is in my new merge phase. Then that would mean, so the way to think what this would look like in the sky is take this psi coordinate and imagine you're living on a sphere, so two-dimensional sphere. You're saying that half of it is a new, half of the sphere is this new bubble phase. Because you say that half of this line is like, here is not half, it's a small angle, but it's half the angle is at this new phase. then what you're saying is half of the sphere is in this new phase, which when you project the sphere onto a map, the dummy map, or say the planet Earth, half of the sphere essentially just means it's at the Pacific Ocean, so you get the Pacific Ocean. So that would be if the angle of the bubble collision in the sky is half, you know, pi essentially. If the angle suspended is pi, that will be a dipole moment in the CMB. So there will be a perturbation in the CMB, which will be a, that will be a physical so a dipole moment. If it's really small, it's going to be a smaller perturbations. So you're going to see the dipole, and you're going to see also all the harmonics. So it's a perturbation, which depends on the collision process, and so people are doing it. So this is kind of nice, because there are potentially getting some feature in the CME, that kind of thing.
Are these talking about the action
field, or is it much stuff, right? Well, I'm not sure what you call it. So there's different time in each. So I'm inside here, inflation was here, but you know, inflation could have been here, mm-hmm. and then the collision is after inflation, but it could have been before. Not sure the slicing is. Remember, this is a trick. Each of these bubbles, which from the outside looks like a finite sized bubble, if you're inside, you're living in an infinite universe, open. It's infinite, of course, because the bubble is growing in time, so it really has an infinite space time bubble. But also the foliation is just, he always looks infinite to you. Right, so I'm not sure, And then the shape of this and trying to predict that. From looking at the literature, again, I'm not working this stuff. I wanted to learn about it, so I can give this lecture. It looks like very ad hoc and very mold dependent. And there's a lot of other ways we know how to get like feature of some special scale. Like you just get, oh, there's a bump in this L. And you can do this just by putting a bump in the internal dimension at that scale. So it's not like this is going to rule out anything. So overall, it's very disturbing what the observational prospects did for internal inflation. But it does have then all this relatical issues by putting fast stuff up. Because one of the things tells with that, I never use this one.
Sorry, just a question about the moment. You said that the negative curvature is the sign of eternal inflation. What it means? It means that if we see the CMU map and it's not negative in any case.
Right. Well, if it's zero, it's fine. But if it's positive, then this scenario is different. I don't know any offhand resolution. So it's possible to rule it out. Also, an interesting thing I should add is that I was hoping for a while that internal inflation could be ruled out from theoretical principle, in the sense that inflation is really hard to get in a theory where you start with a fundamental theory, say like spin theory. Because inflation is really, it's a quantum gravity effect. It's really sensitive to these Planckian corrections, particularly dimension 6 operator, which affects stress. You order one correction to epsilon and entropy. So this is a model which we're testing an experiment, which is if you put M Planck suppressed term, you can rule it out. This is like saying we can rule Gott model at the Gott scale using proton. Okay. We know that SU5 is ruled out, even though we never did an experiment like 10 to 15 GeV, we still know it's ruled out because we are sensitive to proton decay. So the same way, if you have a theory, a string theory, and you give me a model and it has a dimension 6 operator, then it's pulled out because it doesn't want worse dimension. It won't give you inflation. And we need something that does the same thing. So it's really hard to get inflation. The intuition is it should be even harder to give you eternal inflation because it's eternal inflation at the beginning, it's in the more Planckian regime. So it's harder than to give you. And indeed, I know absolutely zero model of string theory which can give you stochastic eternal inflation. They can use the eternal inflation as a stochastic type. I don't have proof that it doesn't exist, but there's no model right now where people have shown that they have a tank suppressor control to the point where they can say this model. So it could be an internalization. It's not really possible with the quantum gravity. Now, that's great for stochastic, but for tunneling, it really looks like there's no argument against it. Because tunneling is Coleman dilution. And unless there's something wrong with the Coleman dilution argument, the bubble, and maybe that's changed when you include corrections, or maybe there's something that we're not understanding right. But if right now, if the Anson-Thelms picture is correct, and you believe that there is a potential out there that you can have different bacteria with different particles, let's say you start with that, then tunneling and tunnelization is also almost guaranteed. So the only thing I want to say here is that it's not clear to me that internalization, while it's definitely a consequence of inflation, it might not survive in a fundamental theory. While inflation might. There's less, it's more constraining to get internalization, I think. But if we are stuck with internalization, one of the consequences tells you, in addition to bubble collision and curvature, is it tells you that there should be at least some parameters which are stochastically determined. That is, they will vary randomly or somewhat randomly following some distribution like Fokker. So they're stochastically. And they will vary in this universe. And depending where you are, you will measure different values. And that's just, again, it's a normal consequence. And it's definitely true, maybe, of the cosmological consequence, being the most obvious one. You tunnel, if you can tunnel to more than one, then which one you tunnel to is become a stochastic process. And then the question is, can we predict? So then that's a completely new way of doing physics. We're saying now, the laws of physics are not special, they're environmental. So it depends on where you are. Okay. So it's not just your local, so it's really the laws of physics. And then, so how do you do physics with this? And so that's where the measure problems comes in. Because how do you calculate the probability by the phi setting? Say that you want a probability that first you reheat. So the n photon value is as the reheating value. And then chi as some, say chi is whatever. With the terms of finite constant or whatnot. Some variables. So you want this to have some specific value that we measure at some time. So you're trying to calculate this. And essentially, this is the same as the Fokker-Planck equation I did at the beginning. Even if you're doing tunneling, this is probably going to still be able to be defined. Tunneling, I think, although I haven't seen it, I think you can describe tunneling via sort of an underlying equation, Fokker-Planck equation. You're trying to determine this guy, but of course, the fact that this depends on time and also often is infinite. If you ask what is a fraction of volume which has chi, this value, of chi, and the fraction of this, well, you're dividing infinity by infinity. And so, there's many ways you can do this. So there's a lot of measures that have been proposed. I do, often people use one of the ones that I know I've seen the most is the volume. So you use the volume, and then you calculate, so and then you really calculate the volume, but you take it as an t equals t max. So you use this probability to calculate the fraction of the volume where you have your variable, whatever value you need. And then you calculate the full volume by, which is not infinite because you cut it off at some maximum t. So you have a cutoff dependent. And that's the problem. This depends on what the gauge choice and the cutoff dependent choice. And then you just take the fraction, say, of so this volume is going to be the volume where chi is as this value chi a at times t max. It's going to be proportional to this pv integrated from 0 to t max. And then, so you integrate the probability over the whole volume to get the whole volume, and then you can calculate the ratios of adding. So what is the ratio that this value versus that value? So it's nothing very complicated, but it's just very ambiguous what you're doing. And because there is this gauge dependence, it makes everything very easy. But I think there is some arguments I think to be made, and this is what people are making, about choosing one cutoff and one system performance over others. And the best argument I've seen actually use like polygraphy or other to justify. And the idea is that in quantum field theory, we also have cutoffs we need to put. And sometimes the answer does depend on the cutoff. And sometimes it's really bad to choose some cutoff just gives you the wrong answer because when you choose that cutoff, it breaks it. So for example, if you're trying to do a UV randomization with a cutoff in an inflating universe, if you choose your cutoff to be fixed and physical instead of co-moving, so if you choose your cutoff in k-space to be co-moving instead of physical, you get very different energy. And one is bad and one is good, and you really need to choose a good one. This is the argument that people are using to say, yeah, there's a cutoff which is special, which is better than the others, because it doesn't break the symmetry. You know, you regulate it, but you regulate it in a way that preserves some symmetry that you think is important. And these guys are using like the center symmetry. And this guy I'm thinking of Bennington theory, for example. So anyway, there are many different proposals. And but the one that like one is to use this volume weighted base for a measure, and to use t the conformal time instead of the normal time. And if you use that time, which is only the gauge choice, but if you use that time, it says that's a preferred choice over the other choice. So once you turn in that time, the answer is fixed. But if you choose a different time, you get a different answer. And they like don't differ just by a little. In one case, probability of having a cosmological constant of like what we have is like one and the other is like zero. Well, it's just we're going to have to, and then he said, well, so a lot of people don't really trust this. But it's really an interesting question. Well, whether you can even do physics this way, or is worthwhile to do it, or anything like this. And once you decide to try to do physics this way, it's actually you ought to do it because it looks well. It's very rigorous. So, yeah, so there's a lot of research here, and that's the measure. The measure problem is trying to find the measure to calculate probability of getting some value from these variables, and it has to be had up. Essentially, the problem again, if you ask for the real measure, it's no problem, but the problem is the observer, us, only live in the region. We don't live in the containing universe. So we only live in these regions, which are re-eaten. And that re-eaten surface, that manifold, is disconnected, it's fractal, it's nobody knows what that manifold is, it's very, very complicated. And we don't know how much of a fraction of the volume. So that's why we had to do some ad hoc. Yes. All right, I'm going to do that. Okay. Any questions? Yeah, like it. Okay. Like it.
There's some relation between these soft and grains. That's
it. Grain?
Yeah.
You mean both universes?
Does it have to be big brains or all of these
different directions? Sorry, which brain? The B brain or?
Yeah, whatever brain. Yeah.
The string theory.
Well,
okay.
Because I remember something from A brain before. But I don't remember what the question was exactly, but she referred to your talk about brains.
Brain inflation, maybe?
All brain inflation. Yeah. Sorry, I'm not.
Brain inflation is one way to obtain inflation in string theory. That's particularly well worked out.
That's quite different from.
Yeah. But it's also this other, the reason I was confused is that in the context of the term inflation, there's this scholar called Boltzmann. And this is nothing to do with, I mean, this is a lot of paradox if you think that the universe is infinite. It doesn't have to be infinite. If the universe is infinite, and you believe in quantum mechanics, so that you believe in random quantum perturbation, technically, you can quantum perturb to whatever you want, since the universe is infinite. And so the question is, why do we not just perturb now? So why don't we just exist for a second? Isn't that the more probable thing to do, to perturb to the higher entropy, the lower entropy state, the beginning, and evolve? It seems like if you start with if you say the universe is, say, completely in this lowest entropy, highest entropy state, and you say, I randomly, in this was argument of Boltzmann, I randomly jump to whatever configuration I want. It's more probable to jump to right now than to jump to the thing right now as I want to be. And that's the throwing paradox. There's a lot of paradox like this, like that. And some of them are actually used, paradoxes are used to eliminate some of the proposals of the measure. So if a measure gives you some kind of paradox, then it's judged to be wrong. You need to take another measure. So it's like the youngness paradox. It's a paradox that it's very unlikely that you would get. If you use a measure, you should have like zero number of equal. I'm not remembering, sorry. But there's a bunch of paradoxes. The Boltzmann brain paradox is like one that's easy to phrase. And it's nothing to do with Eterna. I think you can phrase the Boltzmann brain paradox. If you just have an infinite universe and you allow for quantum perturbation, and you say, well, the most probable thing is that the universe is infinite and it's in this lower entropy state, so it's a gas of radiation, angle, black holes, whatnot. And then you just perturb to it to us. Yes. So it's why that's not the extreme universe. And it could be, if it is, cosmology is. Be boring.